Abdul Rahman Cole. As has been indicated, we have Judge Chafin and Judge Annunziata on the line, and I am Judge Alston. Mr. Gaynor is also present. This comes on the Commonwealth's appeal from the Circuit Court's determination to grant the motion to suppress filed by the defendant. Mr. Shandoval, do you want to save any of your time for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
All right, sir, you may begin when ready.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Chris Shandoval. I represent the Commonwealth in this appeal. This is a case where application of the wrong legal standard led to the wrong legal result. The trial court should have applied the standard enunciated in the United States Supreme Court 2012 decision in Florence versus Board of Chosen Freeholders. That case enunciated a standard which requires courts to show deference to jail officials who enact search policies.
Assuming, for the sake of discussion, that the trial judge applied the wrong standard, would it be appropriate for this court to consider right result, wrong reason analysis?
I cannot think of a right result in this case. I don't believe that that the court did the proper analysis. I do believe that all the facts which were developed at the hearing were sufficient for this court to judge that the trial court got the standard wrong, and would also allow this court to apply the proper standard and make a ruling without remanding. So I suppose if I'm going to make that argument, I have to also argue that the court could employ the correct analysis and then rule against me if the court should choose to do so. But, of course, I would argue that under the proper standard, the trial court erred.
This is Judge Annunziata. Just to try to follow up a little bit on that question that was posed by Judge Alston, to get to the right result for the wrong reason, factually, would have to be on a different legal theory consistent with the Supreme Court case that is at issue here. So I think, if it's not the reasonable suspicion foundation for conducting the search in question, what would be the foundation that was before the trial court that could have been used factually to get the result reached?
The legal standard that the court applied, and then I'll explain how factually the court should have done the analysis, but the legal standard that should have been applied is the standard enunciated in Florence, and the Florence court was just repeating a standard that had been mentioned multiple times, which is that the trial court has to defer to the jail officials who've come up with this policy, the search policy, unless there is substantial evidence in the record that that policy is a result of, is unreasonable or unnecessary or an exaggerated response to problems of jail security. So in applying that analysis, the trial court should have asked, what are the jail security issues here that this detention facility is seeking to address in coming up with this policy?
Wasn't that developed through the testimony of the lieutenant who came in and testified as far as the justification for the jail personnel following the protocol that they did in this case?
Correct. Lieutenant Pinky did come in and testify as to the reasons for the policy. So all of that factual development was done in the record in this case, and would allow this court to rule on the merits of the case without remanding for any further development.
In this case, the lieutenant did what I consider a pretty good job testifying as to the justification for the protocol or the policy that was developed. And as I understand it, and please feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, any person who was arrested for a drug offense, even if he or she was simply an arrestee, was subject to the strip search if the duty sergeant approved it. Is that what you understand the policy to be?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, if that's the policy, why is it that an individual is subjected? Why are drugs singled out as the primary basis for someone being subjected to what I think we would all agree are pretty invasive circumstances?
Well, of course, the policy covered drugs, weapons, and crimes of violence. But drugs in particular are singled out because of the result that having drugs in the jail facility, the multiple problems with jail security that can lead to. And I have cited in my brief multiple cases that go through all the potential problems that drugs can cause in a jail facility, one of which is, people in these detainees trade in contraband, including drugs. So oftentimes drugs can be a source of, like a power source in between the detainees.
That's an interesting point that you make. Let's contrast, if we could, detainees, people who are actually being incarcerated, and that's just another word that I use, people being incarcerated, and arrestees, people who have not yet gone before a magistrate, which the Supreme Court, in the Florence case, at least the concurring opinions, seem to distinguish between the two. Why is it that an arrestee is subject to the same considerations or concerns than a person who is actually being detained pursuant to proper authority?
Well, with respect, Your Honor, I would first take a small issue with the labeling here. As I understand the case law, an arrestee is someone who is arrested and then going to be subsequently released without being taken before a magistrate one way or the other. A detainee, by contrast, is someone who is arrested, taken to the facility, and then booked into the facility to await to go to a magistrate, and then perhaps after being taken to the magistrate, could remain in that booking facility for some time thereafter. So the distinction is between an arrestee, which is not our case, and so there are cases involving searches incident to arrest, such as the King case, which the trial court relied upon, which are inapplicable to this circumstance, where we have someone who is actually being processed into the facility and going to be detained for some time. And I think the reason
Had Mr. Cole been taken before a magistrate?
He had not yet been taken before a magistrate, correct.
And wasn't the underlying charge here a possession of marijuana, which is a misdemeanor charge?
That was one of the two underlying charges. There was a possession of marijuana charge, and there was also a possession of an open container charge. And yes, you're correct. These are misdemeanor charges, minor offenses. But the Supreme Court, starting with Atwater and then continuing through Florence, has counseled against distinguishing between what courts might consider a minor offense compared to what courts might consider a more serious offense. Because for problems of jail security, which is what these cases deal with, predicting whether a detainee is going to be a threat to safety concerns based on whether the underlying offense is minor or major, the court in Florence went to great pains to discuss the fact that it's really hard to make that prediction based on what the underlying offense is. So Atwater said you can arrest regardless of whether it's a major or minor offense, as the courts might distinguish between the two, and Florence kind of built upon that and said we're going to resolve this circuit split, which says you cannot search for minor offenses unless you have reasonable suspicion. The Supreme Court in Florence said that is not a distinction that's worth making any longer going forward. So I would argue that that's not a distinction that the trial court was permitted to make in this case after Florence. And if I could return briefly to your earlier question about the difference between a detainee, or you label him an arrestee, but someone who is not yet entering the general population, someone who has, as I read the opposing counsel's brief, it seems to be premised on the idea that at this facility, the general population is on the top three floors. There seems to be some argument that jail officials should be concerned about those top three floors and problems of jail security there, but that officials aren't supposed to be concerned about security concerns on that first floor. And that first floor looks a lot like a general population floor in terms of having multiple cells. There are 19 cells. Seven of those cells were to hold multiple detainees at once. That's a general policy, is to try to hold these detainees together in the same cells to avoid isolating anyone.
Wouldn't your argument have taken to its extreme, and sometimes that's the way we need to look at it, if a local facility, a regional jail or whatever, had a policy that we're going to strip search anyone who comes through that has a potential of a jail sentence? And we have a policy in place, and we apply that policy across the board, even-handed, have a sergeant or whomever endorsing whatever determination is being made as far as the strip search is concerned. Would that essentially subject anyone who comes through the system, if there's a policy in place, to a strip search?
So within your hypothetical, are these individuals being booked and processed into the facility?
Let's assume they are.
Let's assume that they are. Under my proposed standard, which I think is a standard enunciated by the Supreme Court in Florence, so it's not my standard, but under the Supreme Court standard, what a court judging that policy would have to do would be to ask the question, is this policy, is there substantial evidence in the record that this policy is an exaggerated response to problems of jail security? So the Commonwealth would be required to put on evidence, to put on testimony that says, this is the reason we have this policy, these are the security concerns that we have, this is why we have to do a blanket policy that applies to everyone who comes through those doors for booking, as opposed to doing a more limited policy, which is what we have in this, in my case.
So counsel, would you agree then, but for the second hearing in this matter, your case would have been a difficult one to make?
But for the second hearing in this matter...
There were two separate hearings.
Correct, Your Honor.
As I understand it.
I would have a much more difficult argument to make before that second hearing. I think I would still make the argument and would be on fairly solid footing based on all the case law out there, which I've discussed in my brief, which goes through the accepted problems of jail security caused by drugs and weapons being introduced into jail facilities and the compelling interests that jail officials have in making sure that those sorts of substances and contraband are not allowed in the facility. But you are correct that second hearing did a lot more factual development, which is what I'm basing a lot of my argument on.
Hey, counsel, you're into your rebuttal time. You can obviously continue if you'd like, but if you'd like to save the rest for rebuttal, you're more than welcome to.
I'll go ahead and reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, sir. Thank you. Mr. Gaynor.
Yes, thank you. May it please the court, my name is Kevin Gaynor, and I represent the appellee in this matter, Abdul Cole. First, in order to respond to the Assistant Attorney General, I think there are a number of areas clearly that I take issue. First, as far as whether or not the Florence holding is applicable in this case, I would argue that the trial court correctly found that the Florence holding or rule was not applicable in this case because we are dealing with a class of individuals that Justice Kennedy, in his opinion, Justice Alito, in his concurring opinion, and the other justices who also wrote opinions indicated are a different type or class of individuals potentially deserving of greater scrutiny before the intrusive nature of a strip search is allowed, especially if those individuals are individuals who have not yet gone before a magistrate and had their detention status reviewed and who would not have substantial contact with general population inmates. The Assistant Attorney General, in response to a question, talked about the fact that the way the jail is set up, according to Deputy Penke, that there would be contact with general population inmates because there were general population housing units on the first floor. But in actuality, what Deputy Penke testified to would indicate that by design, the contact between non-general population inmates and general population inmates is substantially limited on purpose.
This is Judge Annunziata.
Yes, Judge.
I guess maybe I'm the only one on this call that doesn't really think, is totally comfortable with a clear definition of what everybody means by general population. In the Florence case, there's no definition of it. And I don't know on what ground it can be suggested necessarily that the population at issue in this case is not the general population. Do you have it? How do you get there?
Your Honor, is it
just a question, basically, essentially, when an individual who is taken into the jail has potential or real contact with other detainees or prisoners, just entering the facility, other than in a single cell, isolated from everyone else, or something more akin to that?
I don't think that's the distinction, Your Honor. I think...
On what ground?
I think, as stated in the Florence case, the security concerns that are at issue here are individuals carrying contraband, whatever it may be, into the facility itself where it could be traded, used, whatever it may be. but that individuals who are not going into, well, not saying that these individuals aren't going into the facility, and indeed, a lot of the cases that are cited here, Craddock and others cited by the Commonwealth in this case, deal with individuals who are taken into the jail facility. The distinction is whether this individual has been booked over, meaning gone before a magistrate to have their detention status reviewed, and whether that individual is going to be quickly potentially released, or instead whether that individual is going to be held for a period of time, either because they did not receive a bond or they cannot post their bond, and sent to one of the general population housing units. And I guess maybe the best way to distinguish between types of inmates in at least the Alexandria jail is where they're housed. Individuals who have not had their detention status reviewed, or individuals who are awaiting posting bond or awaiting release, are held in the booking area, as Detective Penke, I believe, or Deputy Penke indicated. Individuals who are not going to be released, or at least are not going to be released in a brief period of time, are sent into what is considered, or called, for lack of a better term, general population units. Those units are separate and apart from the individuals who remain in booking, who are awaiting to have their detention status reviewed or are awaiting release. So we're talking about two different classes of individuals, and I think that's the distinction in this particular case. And the other reason that I believe that is the distinction is Deputy Penke testified at length that the system is designed, or the jail is designed, to limit contact between the non-jail population inmate and the general population inmate. And that's why booking is set up the way it is. That's why the units are kept separately. That's why individuals don't mix or intermingle. That's even why general population inmates wear uniforms and are quickly identifiable, and non-general population inmates do not. So if two individuals...
How does that set of facts that you just went through very nicely satisfy the underlying concerns for jail security and safety? In other words, the exception that you are articulating, I would think, would have to be consistent with the underlying policy reasons for doing the strip searches in the first place, as Florence looked at, you know, and many courts have looked at, and many jail facilities have looked at. So you think it under the facts of this case, that the distinctions that are made in the Alexandria jail justify an exception that satisfies the concerns for jail security?
I do, Your Honor.
Factually, that can be derived. That's what you're saying.
Yes, Your Honor. And the first thing that I would look at, I think, is in the dissenting opinion on Florence, just the prevalence of people smuggling contraband into the jail was such a small percentage, based upon the studies that were looked at by Justice Breyer, I believe, where we're talking about instances of 0.2% where contraband was smuggled into the jail, or would have been smuggled into the jail, but for suspicionless strip searches. In this particular case, the distinction and the reason the security concerns are different is the very issue that these new individuals who are in the jail, who are awaiting their detention status being reviewed, do not have substantial contact with the general population inmates. And the security concerns, obviously, largely are related to preventing individuals from carrying contraband into the general population areas of the jail. Individuals who are going to be released the same day or the next day and have no substantial contact with these individuals, the security interests for those individuals are substantially less than individuals who are being processed into general population. And contrary to what the Assistant Attorney General indicated, Mr. Cole was never being processed for entry into general population during this period of time. His detention status had not been reviewed. No one knew at the time of the strip search and visual body cavity search in this case whether or not he was going to be released.
But isn't the key here, counsel, as I understand the argument from the Attorney General, is that there's a stated policy and protocol in place which, based upon both objective and subjective criteria, allows the jail personnel in certain circumstances to subject someone to a strip search. I don't necessarily think I would go so far as the Attorney General suggests that if you came up with any policy and you applied it uniformly and all that, that anyone could be subject to a strip search. I don't think I'm anywhere near ready to go that far, but isn't it true that here there was a stated basis for doing this, and one of the things that the lieutenant testified to was that there is some interaction between people in Gen Pop and those who are not. In other words, there's some bathrooms that overlap, I think I recall seeing in the record, and that there are some people who are in Gen Pop who actually come through the area. So there is a basis for this stated concern. It's not some sort of made-up basis. There is an actual basis for the concern of the drugs entering into the general population.
The nature of the contact, Judge, is very, very limited. The bathrooms that are in booking are for non-general population inmates only. I don't think there was any testimony that general population inmates were brought down to use the bathrooms or use the phones that were in this booking area, that the only potential for contact between general population inmates and non-general population inmates were when general population inmates were being brought through booking to be transferred to court, or when a general population, pardon me, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
And trustees. Trustees apparently came through also.
Well, trustees only from the standpoint of the one or the general population inmate who cleans the cells once they're vacated. I don't believe there was any indication that other trustees or any general population inmate frequents booking. And indeed, they don't do that without, even in the limited circumstances where they do, they don't do that except in front of at least four deputies in booking who are there specifically to supervise any, however limited, interaction between general population inmates and non-general population inmates, as well as just any interaction between the inmates at all. But the bathrooms in the booking area are not for general population inmates. That's not an instance where they would have contact. The phones, Deputy Penke testified that they're phones in the units that the general population inmates use. They don't get brought down to booking to use those phones. The general population units, even the ones on the first floor, are not near booking. They are secured. You cannot go in and out of them without a deputy letting you in or out. The general population inmates do not wander through the halls of the jail, even on the first floor. And the non-general population inmates also don't wander the halls. They're not allowed to leave the booking area if they're not in a cell without a deputy accompanying them, according to Deputy Penke. And if they're in one of the holding cells, they are never housed with general population inmates. And those cells, if they're inside them, are locked, and they can't get out unless a deputy lets them out.
Counsel, and I don't want to put you on the spot as far as writing a policy or protocol for the Alexandria City Jail, but what type of protocol or policy do you think, based upon the Florence standard, would be reasonable for the Alexandria City Jail to adopt?
I think the reasonable policy, again, Florence doesn't indicate that strip searches can be suspicionless across the board. I think Justice Alito, in his concurring opinion, made that clear. I think the policy that the Alexandria Jail should put in force is a policy that's consistent with the Florence rule and consistent with the Bell versus Wolfish rule, and that is that individuals who are being booked over, that is being processed for entry into general population, can be strip searched. And that is, there are clear security concerns that justify that policy. I'm not going to argue today that I've already stated today that it seems like the incidents where contraband is smuggled into jails is minuscule, but be that as it may, individuals who are being processed into general population can be strip searched. Individuals who have not gone before a magistrate, who are not being processed into general population, or who are otherwise awaiting release and are separated from general population inmates, the jail would need reasonable suspicion in order to strip search those individuals.
Counsel, this is Teresa, Judge Chafin, and
yes, Judge.
You continue to reference Florence, but it seems like that perhaps either I or you have a misreading of Florence. There was a general rule set forth by the plurality, and you've mentioned the dissent, you've mentioned parts of things that could happen in the future that Alito and also Kennedy discussed in their opinion. But where did they deviate from reaching a rule? There are no exceptions to that rule in that opinion that I read.
Well, Your Honor, Justice Kennedy, in his majority opinion, states specifically that this case does not require the court to rule on the types of searches that would be reasonable in instances where, for example, a detainee will be held without assignment to the general jail population and without substantial contact with other detainees. Justice Alito, in his concurring opinion, states effectively the same thing, but he goes further and states it is important to note that the court does not hold that it is always reasonable to conduct a full strip search of an arrestee if that arrestee's detention has not been reviewed by a judicial officer and who could be held in available facilities apart from the general population. So both Justice Kennedy in writing the majority opinion and Justice Alito in concurring with that opinion state that while the court has set forth a general rule regarding strip searches, there are potentially exceptions to that general rule, and this specific situation is the one they mention. And this is an instance where they say these individuals are potentially in a different position than individuals being committed to general population, and given the intrusive nature of a strip search and the reasons for it must be considered constitutionally reasonable, and that in instances where an individual is being held for a minor offense, as here, and is likely to potentially be released quickly, as here, a suspicionless strip search does not pass constitutional muster.
Well, counsel, I believe that what they stated was that ultimately that certain exceptions could, and similar to what you're proposing, could arise in the future, but that they fail to deal with them now. They merely note that they can arise in the future, was my reading, but perhaps I've misread the opinion.
I would not suggest that, Judge. what I am saying, however, is that the exception, while they didn't enumerate, exception after exception, the one exception that all of the justices discussed was the potential exception that is our very set of facts. An individual who is pre-book over or has not been placed before a magistrate, whose detention status has not been reviewed, who is in jail for minor offenses, which these clearly were. One was non-jailable, and the other is a possession of marijuana misdemeanor. And even if you include the failure to appear warrant that was outside of Alexandria, which is also a misdemeanor because it was for a misdemeanor offense, still you have a situation where this individual was very likely to be released. And more importantly, the deputy and the arresting officer had no idea whether that would occur because they don't make that determination.
Counsel, you're outside of your 15 minutes, and we let you go because the argument is a very good argument, but your time is concluded. We'll give you 30 seconds to sum up.
What we're asking, obviously, is that the court affirm the trial court's ruling in granting the motion to suppress in this case. Thank you very much.
All right, so Mr. Chandevel, you have about 4 minutes. You may proceed when ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to try to make just 2 points, if I could. First of all, I think Judge Chafin's reading of Florence is absolutely correct, and I would kind of implore the court to consider the district court judge in Iowa, his decision in Rattray versus Woodbury County, which I cited in my brief at page 16. I think the court there does an excellent job of analyzing the decision and notes that this is a broad new rule, and the court says it might in the future consider exceptions, but by saying that, it's implicit that until that time, this broad new rule applies in cases just like in our case. And the language from Judge Kennedy that opposing counsel quoted to try to say that the majority was creating an exception right now came from part four of the majority, well, of what would have been the majority opinion, but part four is the only portion of that opinion that Justice Thomas did not join. So that's actually part of the plurality. So under the majority opinion in Florence, this is a broad new rule subject to possible future exceptions that the Supreme Court might create but which have not yet been created at this time, and so this court is not in a position to
apply. Judge Nunziata, it's very hard to, I don't mean to interrupt, but you know, these three-way calls on speaker and all that, it's impossible to hear each other. But anyway, I didn't mean to, if you need to finish that, please do, but I do have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
I don't know, would you agree that the standard is pretty much the one that was initially articulated, that that if the evidence shows the policy was either unnecessary or extraordinary under the circumstances of the case, if the evidence shows that it was unnecessary and extraordinary, then the policy has to be struck down. And isn't that the standard ultimately, that it's looking at the underlying foundation for such a policy in relationship to the need to keep the facility of the prisons and jails safe and secure, et cetera, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that is exactly the standard.
Okay, if you look at it that way, my question is, what is the evidence in this particular case that the policy was necessary? Let's just take that, or I don't want to say non, or somewhat ordinary, or just the policy was necessary in light of the circumstances existing in the Alexandria jail, as proved by the evidence. And you know, it begs one underlying question that I also have, which I might as well get into, which is, there was a lot of abstract data, abstract in the sense that in Florence, the court looked at all the possible horrors that could occur based on other cases, but not necessarily, I won't say not necessarily in the case before it, but the existence of what I call abstract horrors, which we all know about from our reading, if nothing else, is that going to do it for what happens in Alexandria, or does something in the Alexandria case have to show the policies followed here were necessary? What is it that showed they were necessary here, if you agree with what I'm articulating?
Sure. Well, I'd make just two points in response to that question. I think it's a good question. Point number one is that I would state the standard slightly differently than Your Honor has stated it based on my reading of Florence. In Florence, the standard is, the courts have to show deference unless there is substantial evidence in the record that the policy was unnecessary, unjustified, or an exaggerated response to problems of jail security. So that really, instead of putting the burden to prove that, okay, you have to give me substantial evidence that you need this policy, they actually, you have to look for substantial evidence that you don't need the policy. And so even if the court finds that perhaps the Commonwealth could have done more development of the facts in terms of, you know, these are prior cases of drugs use snuck into the facility, that's not really the analysis that the U.S. Supreme Court endorses in Florence. It's more asking, is there evidence that you don't need this policy? And I think because of all the development and the facts as to the interaction between the detainees in the booking section, and because also, so getting to facts of this case, counsel conceded on the record, and I go through this discussion on page 12 of my brief, and his concessions are on page 205 of the appendix, that drugs are sometimes snuck into this jail facility and that these are security concerns that deputies have to deal with. And even went so far on page 131 of the appendix to concede that Cole would have had opportunities to pass off or get rid of these drugs if he had been in this booking section of the facility for 2 or 3 days. So that those facts, while not developed the amount of specificity that perhaps Your Honor is looking for, those facts were conceded at this hearing. And so based on those facts being conceded, based on the facts that were developed in terms of the substantial contact between the detainees in this booking section, I think that the defendant has not met his burden of showing substantial evidence in the record that this policy is unnecessary or unjustified or exaggerated.
Counsel, doesn't your analysis sort of invert the constitutional inquiry? Because it was always my understanding that it is not the defendant's obligation to prove a Fourth Amendment violation, but rather it is the government's obligation to disprove that there was a Fourth Amendment violation. Invert the analysis.
Well, I don't think it does. I understand the court's concern. I would just have to first say that it's not my analysis. It's the U.S. Supreme Court's analysis, and they know much better than I do as to what is a proper showing to require the Commonwealth and the defense to make. But that is the way that they phrase the standard. I think it's because the court recognizes that in these contexts, these security concerns are so important. And again, I think Judge Nunziata, who asked a question about the difference between general population and the booking section, I think that question goes right to a very important point, which is, I think, a fatal flaw in opposing counsel's argument, is that he cannot make any argument that the detainees in the booking section, that there should be any less security concerns there than there are in general population. The same concerns we have about drugs in general population apply for these 2 to 3 days in these 19 cells where multiple detainees are held together at the same time, 7, 8, 9, 10, up to, I think, 18 chairs lining a wall in this area. The same security concerns about drugs in the general population apply in the booking section, the booking area. And I don't think that the U.S. Supreme Court...
Counsel, your rebuttal time is expired. To give you 30 seconds to sum up if you'd like.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm just saying that I don't think the U.S. Supreme Court would make that distinction between general population and the booking section in a case like this. And even the supposed exception that a couple of justices mentioned might be down the road did not apply in a case like this when there's this much contact between detainees in the booking section of the facility with a policy that is as narrowly tailored to certain offenses as this one is. So for those reasons, Your Honor, we would ask the court to reverse and to remand for further proceedings.
All right, counsel, thank you very much. I think I speak for both Judge Chafin and Judge Annunziata when I say that the argument that you all have put forward has been excellent, without a doubt. And we thank you for your participation, and now the judges will retire to conference. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.